We just say this is the highest stage of organic. It's always been the philosophical basis for organic, but we allowed the government and special interests to poke their heads in the organic standards, and it disillusioned a number of people, and it obscured the essence of what we were always talking about. So we think Organic Consumers Association, we always talk about organic and regenerative, or regenerative organic. I mean, you can't say that every single time you use the word, but you need to readily say that so that people understand there's no way to be regenerative unless you are also organic.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Dave Chapman, co-director of the Real Organic Project, a grassroots farmer-led movement trying to reclaim organic and bring back integrity and transparency in that effort. You're about to hear an interview that I did with Ronnie Cummins back in 2020. Ronnie is the director of the Organic Consumers Association and also one of the founders of Regeneration International. The things that we said then are just as true today. I hope you enjoy this interview. I was pleased to see the other day that Ronnie just signed up for the Real Organic pre-conference at EcoFarm on January 17th. It's going to be a lively conversation from farmers and eaters and a chef. Paul Hawken will be our keynote, talking about how do we create a viable organic movement in America. So I hope you join us there, and let's go on to the interview with Ronnie now. Here I am talking to Ronnie Cummins, founder of Organic Consumers Association and Regeneration International, and author of Grassroots Rising. Ronnie, welcome to the Real Organic Podcast.
Well, good to be with you today.
That's great. I haven't seen you in a while. Last time I saw you, it was talking with Shelley Pingree and Jim McGovern and all of that at Abby's house.
That's right.
So tell me, let's just dive right in. How did you get to become an organic activist?
Well, I grew up in Southeast Texas, and my grandparents were from Southwestern Louisiana, but they had a family farm that they set up in Southeast Texas. So I used to go there every weekend and during the summers. And they were classic family farmers with every kind of animal imaginable, every kind of crop imaginable. And I developed a real love for the animals and for the farm and the outdoors. And so even though I didn't become a farmer, I always carried this with me. And in the late 1960s, when I was active in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, racial justice movement, we decided, a bunch of us, that in about 1970, that we needed to incorporate food into our counterculture, into our revolution, if you will. So a bunch of us started moving back to the land, starting food co-ops in cities, getting involved in the co-op movement. And so I got involved, my first food co-op, probably in 1970. And so,
where was that?
That was in Buffalo, New York. I continued that. I moved back to Texas for a while, did organizing there, and I was always a member of food co-ops. I was always at least a weekend visitor to rural communes, and I was determined that food and farming should be part of an overall social justice, peace perspective. So I did a whole lot of different organizing from 1970 until really for a couple of decades. I spent 5 years in Central America. But in 1992, I got offered a job by Jeremy Rifkin in Washington, D.C., of the Foundation on Economic Trends to be the campaign director for a new campaign called the Pure Food Campaign. And what we were going to do as the Pure Food Campaign was take on this new technology of genetic engineering. The bovine growth hormone was the first genetically engineered food product, but also take on factory farming and McDonald's. So I was the director of the Beyond Beef campaign, which was a gigantic pressure campaign against McDonald's in 93 and 94, while we began campaigning against genetically engineered food and crops. And then in 1997, it became clear that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was going to try to degrade organic standards by allowing GMOs and irradiated food and sewage sludge to be still called organic. So I started a campaign called SOS, Save Organic Standards, and it got rolling at the end of 97 and really got rolling in the beginning of 98. So we decided that we looked around and there wasn't a mass-based organization representing organic consumers. We had the Organic Trade Association, which at the time was stabbing us in the back and going along with this degradation of standards. We had the Natural Products Association, which dealt with natural health, but there really wasn't a mass-based. So we started Organic Consumers Association right at the beginning of 1998 and have continued campaigning and educating ever since. And over time, it became clear to many of us in the food movement that the climate crisis was bearing down on us, and that food and farming played a major role in producing this climate crisis. But when we discovered, a group of us 10 or 12 years ago, that it could really be part of the solution, we started working, writing, researching, communicating about the connection between organic food and farming and resolving the climate crisis. And so in 2014, a group of us got together at the New York City Climate March, which was a gigantic march of 400,000 people. But Vandana Shiva from India and Andre Lowe, president of IFOAM, the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements, Steve Rye, the CEO of Mercola, Dr. Bronner's staff people, people from Rodale Institute, and we said, let's form a global umbrella group called Regeneration International. So that was the beginning of Regeneration International, which has carried on. And over time, I spent more and more time south of the border again because our organic consumer and farmer network in Mexico is quite sizable. We set up an organic research farm, an organic grocery store, restaurant, basically a food hub. We set up office for Regeneration International in Mexico City and San Miguel de Allende, partly because it was a lot cheaper to run an international network from Mexico than it was from New York or Washington or San Francisco, and partly because we wanted to be as close as we could to the global campesino or small farmer movement, and it really it keeps you aware of those issues if you're living and working in the developing world. And so for the last 10 years, I spend 6 months a year working from Minnesota, northern Minnesota, where we also have an organic research farm as well as our campaign office. And then I spend 6 months in north central Mexico, the desert highlands in Guanajuato, and in our office in Mexico City. So that's what brought me up to today. And we're very active with natural health groups as well as organic consumer groups and farmer groups around the world.
All right. Well, let's unpack some of that because there's a lot there. So one interesting thing to me is that really you came to the organic movement already as an activist. And, you know, you were active in other, you know, really important social issues. And then you brought that activism to food and to farming and to agriculture. And, it was all growing out of the ferment of that time, I think. And that was the ground that the organic movement really, really grew in America. When you started Organic Consumers Association, I don't know if it's changed, would you say that the mission remains the same as it was back then?
Yes, although we didn't understand the climate crisis in the early years the way we started to understand it 10 or 12 years ago. And so yeah. Our slogan was always campaigning for health, justice, and sustainability. And I guess we would change that today to health, justice, and regeneration. So,
yeah.
But we always did try to connect the dots. We always emphasize fair trade as well as non-pesticide organic farming. And we always noticed, of course, that consumers were primarily passionate about their health and the health of their families. And then they were also concerned about the environment. But it was our job to connect the dots. And so I did start out as an anti-war anti-racist campaigner in the South, but a whole bunch of us across the country at the same time read Diet for a Small Planet by Francis yeah. Moore LePay in 1970-71. And then we were also reading books by Scott Nearing and Helen Nearing about going back to the land. And we were connecting the dots, and we realized, especially as the repression got really, really hard on African American and Latino and even, you know, white activists, that we needed to project more than what we were against, that we needed to project the outlines of the new society that we were for. And so as we researched and talked to older activists, we realized that food co-ops and farm communes and what we call today food hubs could be a real good example of what we were talking about for the kind of society we wanted. And so I always stuck to that, but I was never offered a job until Jeremy Rifkin said, hey, you're a pretty good organizer. I've seen from the anti-nuclear movement and the Central America Solidarity Movement, anti-war movement, I want to build a mass consumer movement to attack industrial agriculture and GMOs and to promote organic. Would you be interested? And so that led me to become a DC-based campaigner. But quickly after a few years, I realized I didn't like living in DC 12 months a year. And so I made part of my campaign work to be based both in the Midwest and Washington, D.C., and then later Mexico as well.
So I think it's interesting to me that, you know, I think it was Will Brinton who said to me that Will's a soil scientist, and he said in the, gosh, it's been 80 years since Albert Howard and Louisa Howard did their work, that virtually all of the soil and nutritional science has actually supported their observations. It's just given much better explanation of why what they said was true, that we could explain better, you know, why those had such positive outcomes for people and for plants and for animals. And I think that there are a couple things that you've mentioned that I don't think the Howards actually thought of. And one, this worker welfare. And, you know, I honestly don't know what the situation was in England at the time, but I know that in America, when the organic movement really was being built, it was a whole bunch of small farms. And actually, mostly the goal was for the few people on those farms to be able to make any kind of living at all. And, you know, now organic has gotten much bigger. And I know that an awful lot of the organic food in America comes from the Southern Hemisphere. And although it's true in America, too, that there are real issues around worker welfare and worker right and worker justice. But it's even a bigger issue in the Southern Hemisphere. Could you talk about that just a little?
Yes, for people who have spent a lot of time outside of the U.S. in the developing world, it's pretty clear that half the world still lives in rural areas, you know, and family farms and family herding and so on are still the norm, not factory farms and industrial scale farms in most of the world. It also is very clear that it's extremely difficult for small farmers and ranchers and rural communities to make a living, especially with NAFTA and free trade and World Trade Organization and, you know, dumping all these commodities on these countries. So I have been able to combine my passion for human rights with rural economic development and organic farming in the developing world. And you see that, you know, like in Spanish, if you look in the dictionary, there's not even a word called organic, you know? It's like, and part of the reason for that is because most of the farming, most of the culinary tradition is still natural, or was until, you know, 20 years ago. And so I really appreciate the fact that farmers around the world can immediately relate to an organic consumer activist from the United States who also thinks that fair trade is very important. And I personally enjoy spending a lot of my time around poor people but poor farmers and trying to work with them to develop new ways to farm and survive that are based on their tradition, but that can help them right here. And so for the last year and a half, I've been passionately involved in a new agroforestry system, regenerative agroforestry system, that some small farmers in Mexico have developed using desert plants, agaves and mesquite trees in particular, to create an amazing new way to raise animals holistically, to graze holistically, and to produce fermented animal feed from a very prolific plant, the agave plant, that is growing as we talk on 20% of the world's terrain. So my current passion is, okay, 40% of the world is either arid or semi-arid, according to the United Nations. That is, it's in danger of turning to desert, or it's half desert already. You can't really grow crops on this 40% of the world's surface unless you have a well and irrigation. And of course, in Mexico, 86% of farmers don't have a well, and they're never going to get a well. So how do you, they have land, they have livestock, they have their native traditions, but how do you bring this into the 20th century and restore that land? And the answer that we've discovered in Mexico, right in front of our faces, is this agroforestry or intensive silver pasture system that we are embarking upon. And I must say, in my whole life, I've never been more excited about a project than I am about this, because it can sequester huge amounts of carbon. It can produce extremely nutritious animal feed, and it doesn't require irrigation. And I'm working in a country in Mexico. People may not know this, but over half the land in Mexico is still owned by they're called ejidos. They're rural villages. And this is a product of the Mexican Revolution and the land reform of 1932 through 34. But basically, small farmers and rural communities in Mexico have title to the majority of the land. The only problem is that this land is, it doesn't have irrigation. It's been overgrazed for hundreds of years. The Spaniards deforested it. It's really challenging to be a farmer. But on the other hand, people have no choice. There's 4 million family farms left in Mexico, a lot more than there are in the United States. And people are very excited about organics and regeneration and staying on the land. They don't want their kids to have to migrate to the United States. They're concerned about the organized crime, the cartels that prey on poor communities. And I think the farmers of the world, if they can get the support of us in North America and Europe and Japan and Australia, are going to rise up.
Are they mostly growing crops for subsistence, or are they growing, how much are they growing for export? Like, how much is our market important to their economy?
It's only the farms, that the more industrialized farms that are growing for export. Like I said, 86% of the farmers don't have wells. These are all growing for self-subsistence and for their surrounding communities. The problem is that you can't subsist anymore, on these lands. So the corn and beans and squash, which are actually, together in combination, this is a very good system. It doesn't require pesticides or artificial fertilizers. You get some highly nutritious food. The problem is that with climate change, you can't really grow the milpa anymore. You can plant the corn and the beans and the squash, and you can pray for rain and predictable weather, but you don't get it most years. And so we've reached an impasse where subsistence farmers can no longer make a living. They do have livestock for their own consumption. And in our area, there's lots of sheep and goats, especially, and some cows. But basically, they're all losing money. And so you get the average family in Mexico has their yearly income, households, about $5,000. And most of that on the average comes from their relatives sending back money from the States or Canada. So everyone in the rural areas looks for a job in nearby cities. And, they can only farm for the most part on the weekends and the afternoons. And it's a losing proposition. But they still do have title to land. And they've got this stubborn love for the land and their culture. And they have refused to give up. And so that's what makes it so exciting to, have helped build an organic farmer and consumer network in Mexico and in Central America, where I've spent a whole lot of time.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of those people in America sending back their paychecks are planting and harvesting our crops. So
that's right.
It's a very complicated story. So the other thing that we mentioned that I think is genuinely new from the time of Albert and Louisa Howard is climate change. And it's not that climate change is new. Climate has changed many times on the planet, and I think that this particular round was already happening in 1940, but we didn't have any awareness of it, except for a couple, unique scientists. So we're becoming more and more aware of this now. Tell me, in your mind, how does this change? Well, let's start with organic farming, seeing as, you started the Organic Consumers Association. So how does this change our attitude or your attitude towards organic farming?
Well, when we fought to preserve or to improve organic standards over the last few decades, we didn't know as much about the climate as we know now. We didn't know that degenerate food and farming practices were a very large contributor to the problem. And we certainly didn't know that we were sequestering carbon in large quantities by carrying out organic practices. We didn't understand that agroforestry and silvopasture, the combination of reforestation and growing crops and raising animals together, really sequester a lot of carbon. So that has risen to the forefront at the same time as people's practical experience has taught them we can't farm anymore. Like, one of our staff people is in Zimbabwe, Precious Fury, and she works with for many years with the Savory Institute, developing rotational grazing, holistic grazing, and teaching small subsistence farmers in Zimbabwe these techniques. But the weather there has become impossible, and people are literally not just impoverished, they're going hungry a good part of the dry season. And so it's an imperative for people there. And, you know, one of our directors, Andre Lowe, lives in northern Queensland and in Australia. And Australia is seeing, even though they've got a lot of good practitioners, especially of organic grazing, their climate is spiraling out of control. Other staff people we have in Miramar and Asia, it's the same story all over the world. And when you look in the Midwest, it's really not that different here. It's becoming incredibly difficult for family farmers and ranchers to make a living without selling their soul out to the factory farm system or Monsanto. And even then, you're living a precarious existence. So I think it's a moral imperative now to save the climate for our kids and our grandkids and the future generations. It's a technical necessity if you want to farm. You can't really farm organically in a narrow way, monocropping, for example, organically, like you could before. And it's also a economic imperative. So I've been so happy to see organic and regenerative come together over the last few years. And I think this is the way forward. I mean, Howard and them instinctively knew, the modern pioneers of organic agriculture, they instinctively knew that soil health was the key to everything else. They simply didn't understand, they didn't realize yet, that it was also the key to a stable climate. And so I'm really happy that it's coming together and that people are starting to see, the highest stage of organic incorporates this traditional emphasis on soil health and animal health and biodiversity and local and regional production for local and regional markets.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, let's talk about regenerative agriculture. I have to say I have concerns. I have no concerns about what you mean by regenerative agriculture. But just as you fought for many years now to keep meaning and integrity in what the word organic means, I would say that we're going to have we already have exactly the same fight with regenerative. It's everywhere. And I did a little quick, look around and to see who all was claiming to be regenerative now. And it includes most of the multinational corporations involved in food. If you look at their websites, they all proudly wave the regenerative banner, and I I got a letter from Aaron Stevens talking about being at Expo West a few years ago when General Mills had a block-long stand and with their famous claim to take, they're going to take 1 million acres regenerative. And Aaron pushed them and said, well, what does that mean? And nobody at the stand knew what it meant. And but we're pretty sure it means 1 million acres of glyphosate. So I'm just, you know, I see, I want to say this so that we can be clear that we're not talking about a word. We're talking about a way of farming. And what you mean by it and what other people mean by it is probably already different. So what do you mean when you say regenerative farming?
We just say this is the highest stage of organic. It's always been the philosophical basis for organic. But we, you know, we allowed the government and special interests to poke their heads in the organic standards, and it disillusioned a number of people, and it obscured the essence of what we were always talking about. So we think Organic Consumers Association, we always talk about organic and regenerative, or regenerative organic. I mean, you can't say that every single time you use the word, but you need to readily say that so that people understand there's no way to be regenerative unless you are also organic. And, you know, but I deal a lot with ranchers like American Grass-Fed Association are one of our top allies in our current campaign, Boycott Big Meat. But just in general, the American Grass-Fed Association or the Savory Worldwide, these grazers, these are people who did not come out of the 60s alternative culture movement like I did. They tend to be skeptical, and they tell me things like, well, USDA organic standards for beef only require 30%, you know, of their feed to be, you know, minimum 30% to be grass and fodder, pasture grass and fodder. How is that, you know, how is that better than regenerative? And so we're trying to get people on both sides. I mean, we'd love to make organic standards for animal husbandry, you know, stricter the way they should have been all along. But we've been up against some powerful special interests, and we haven't yet been able to do that. So in the meantime, we got these two movements, and we're doing our best to get people to talk together and communicate and unite around the idea of organic and regenerative, you know. And we like some of these certification standards as a, you know, setting a bar and a high bar. But I also think we just have to keep, we've got to keep educating the public. One good thing about since COVID-19 broke out is that there's been an upsurge in purchasing organic foods. You know, there's been an upsurge in people thinking about their diet, their health. People are eating at home a lot more. They're becoming better cooks. We're having the family meals again at much higher frequency. We're understanding the plight of workers in the food chain. I mean, in the U.S., we got 20 million workers in the food chain, if you count restaurant workers and, you know, truck drivers and warehouse people and farm workers. You know, a good 40% of these 20 million people can't afford organic food, or that's what they say. And so I think now people are more aware a little bit of the plight of slaughterhouse workers, farm workers, grocery store clerks, truck drivers, and so on. And we're in a position as we pull out of this mass panic, I believe, to have an organic and regenerative recovery from the disaster that we find ourselves in now. And I sure hope that we will continue this. I think the nice thing about eating organic food and preparing organic food is that once you start doing it, I don't think people are just going to go back to the way things were before January. I really think a lot of this is going to stick with us. And we got to take it further, though. I mean, it's food is medicine and can heal us, or else food is poison. And organic is medicine. It's good medicine. And industrial food, highly processed food, all this added sugar, all this junk food is poison. And I think that's the reason why the United States is leading the world in terms of deaths from COVID-19. Why do we lead the world in terms of chronic disease, you know, the heart attacks, the cancer, and so on? It's because our industrialized food system, on the whole, is the worst in the whole world for your health, for the treatment of animals, for the damage we're doing to the environment. But we also can turn this around. We are turning it around. I mean, when we started Regeneration International in the fall of 2014, almost no one had heard the term regenerative used in that way. And now it's the buzzword, where even Monsanto, I saw this month, Monsanto says, oh, okay, we're going to be regenerative now. You know, we're going to pay carbon credits to farmers for no-till, and, you know, well, maybe we won't give them money. We'll give them free Roundup, you know, if they're sequestering carbon by not tilling their land. So it's like, you are absolutely right that we have to fight for the real meaning of regenerative. And really, the real meaning of regenerative, it's got to have organic and regenerative in there.
Yeah, I agree. I was just amazed. I mean, Cargill, Danone, everybody, you know, we've got Purdue Foods, and everybody loves this word. You know, I will say that it is a good thing that everybody loves the word. It means that there's a growing food movement that's asking for it. And obviously, these big companies don't actually care. Whatever it is, you want it, we'll try and at least offer you something with that name on it. And, you know, what we have to do is build on that, which is that people do want an actual change from the way food is conventionally grown. So let me ask you one question. You make explicit that it should be organic regenerative, and I don't know anything in organic regenerative that's different from what I would call real organic or deep organic.
Right.
Would you would agree with that?
I agree with that.
All right. Just so I understand. You know, I don't want to fight with people about words. I didn't even want to fight about organic, but I do want to offer people what they want.
Yes.
And I want to make clear what they're getting, because I think that's a very important thing that we fight for. We built a swing set, and a bully came along in a playground and knocked us off the swing set. And the question is, do we leave the playground and go someplace else and build another swing set? Or do we say no, and we get together a bunch of kids that helped us build it and say, this is our swing set? And, I think that's where we're at. I think it's too important right now to go build another swing set. We need to have real change happening faster than that.
Yes. No, I mean, one of our current campaigns is just to basically tell elected public officials, you know what? We're tired of business as usual in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We want an organic farmer as the next Secretary of Agriculture, period. What do you think about that, Joe Biden? What do you think about that, Mr. Trump? And, you know, right now, I think Biden's going to win. That's pretty obvious. I think the Democrats are going to take back control of the Senate. But I am not confident that we're not going to see a Vilsack or Heidi Heitkamp as Secretary of Agriculture. And now's the time to be really vocal to people who don't either understand it or who don't want to understand it because they get campaign contributions from Big Ag and Big Food. But we have to stand up. And, I mean, I don't want to spend the rest of my life fighting rear guard battles for organic standards. I want the economy to go organic and to go regenerative, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because we don't have any choice. If we don't go, as I point out in my new book, Grassroots Rising, if we don't change our food and farming system to be organic and regenerative, we are not going to solve the climate crisis and things are going to be spiraling out of control. I mean, it's so it's hitting my hometown, this Hurricane Laura, the last couple of days. I mean, how much clearer does it have to be that we have whacked the weather out to where violent storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, and now we got all these fires going at the same time in California, and you look around the world at what's going on. Organic, we shouldn't panic, as we used to say, but we got to go organic. And that's right. The only way forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Ronnie, you are an activist, and your goal is institutional transformation. I'm curious. One of the people we'll be interviewing for the symposium is a great guy, Paul Holmbeck from Denmark. And he talks about what they're doing in Denmark. So they have committed, if I have the numbers right, about $150 million to take Denmark organic as quickly as they can get there. And that'd be about $19 billion in American terms. And that's a much bigger commitment than the American government has made so far. Maybe we'll get there. But you start to think about the possibilities. And the thing I love about that is that they're not saying we're doing this for people who buy organic. They're saying we're doing this for all of our citizens, because we think even if you choose not to buy organic in the store, and it would still be a choice, but we think that you benefit by more and more of our agriculture being organic, that you benefit environmentally, you benefit socially, you benefit nutritionally, because after all, if it does make a difference to health, everybody's paying the healthcare costs there. So I'm curious, what do you think about that? Do we have a hope of bringing that kind of transformation to America?
Well, I mean, we almost got Bernie Sanders as the nominee for the Democratic Party in 2016 and then again this year. And I wrote a bit about Bernie's food and farm platform as part of the Green New Deal. And he was putting out $800 billion as a figure over the next 10 years. Not all at once, but it would take $80 billion to transform our industrial food and farming system, factory farms, pesticides, GMOs, to one that was predominantly organic. And I think that's we need to raise our sights on that. And one of the reasons I think we can achieve that, getting people to see that this is really important, is because, there's a new book, Food Fix, by Mark Hyman, that I love. But he talks about how our industrial food system causes $15 trillion in damages worldwide every year. And that he talks about the Food as Medicine Caucus in the Ag Department in the U.S. Congress points out. It's cheaper. We could give organic food out for free to people on Medicare Medicare in nursing homes and people on Medicaid, and save money for the insurance companies, save money for these government programs, and give it away for free. I mean, of course, we'd want to have make cooking classes available. We'd want for the kids to be able to visit the organic farms and so on. But we are literally bankrupting the economy and destroying the climate by sitting back with business as usual. And I think we should ask for more. Let's frame things. Food is either good medicine or food is poison. And we cannot afford to poison the body politic anymore, period. And so let's do it right. It's not that poor people don't know the difference between organic food and conventional food. You know, I mean, when I'm in a co-op or grocery store or wherever I am, everything in my basket is always organic. Okay? You can't tell me that that clerk doesn't notice that everything I'm buying is organic. And what are they saying? What are they thinking to themselves? Oh, look at that dumb idiot wasting all that money on organic and on grass-fed beef and dairy. You know, what an idiot. You know, they could be buying much cheaper food. No, I think they're thinking, I wish I could do that. You know, I wish I made enough money as a grocery store clerk or a stock person or the person who delivered this in the truck or the person who works out in the fields. It's like, this isn't right. Poor people know the difference between good food and low-grade food. And we are poisoning them with our institutional policies, forcing them to cut corners on food. And this notion that organic is too expensive, well, organic food should never cost less than what it takes to pay the farmer and all the people in the food chain a fair wage. You know, that's it. We cannot think in other terms. So if people don't have the money, which a large proportion of our population feel like they're so economically stressed, they have to cut corners with their food, we need to put money in their pockets or put food in their houses. And there's no use to hand out, you know, junk food like our food stamp program does. I mean, when you think about, well, $50 billion a year or something like that for food stamps, that's a lot of money. But when people are buying Coca-Cola and Pepsi, you know, and processed food from Kraft or General Mills, it's like people have enough calories. They don't have enough nutrition. And we need to solve this. There is no way to solve this without an organic and regenerative food system that is socially just. And the day of reckoning, it's already here. But we're gonna see some big changes, I believe, in the next decade. I think we're going to see some big changes in the next 12 months. And thank goodness we've got a bunch of us older people in the organic movement. Because in the 60s, when I first became an activist, we didn't have a lot of older people to give us guidance or to share their wisdom. Now they do, and young people and us older folks, I think, are going to get the job done.
Yeah. Michael Pollan once said, he might have been quoting Obama, I can never quite remember, but he once said, you know, until we can light up the switchboards, we don't really have a food movement. And by lighting up the switchboards, he meant that if somebody in Congress votes wrong on something that's important to us, that we flood them and they go, whoa, okay, I'm sorry, we'll fix that. And I think the point of that was that we need to, I don't know if you remember that meeting with Shelley and Jim, but I said, you know, you all are heroes, you're champions, but you can't do it without a movement at your back. It's not enough to have some brave souls who are up there throwing themselves on their sword of their political career. They need to have many people behind them so that they're representing us. And I think that, of course, this is what you're trying to do with the Organic Consumers and with Regeneration International. So it's what we're trying to do with the Real Organic Project. So my question is, do you think we're going to get there?
I do, because you look at who voted for Bernie. You know, there's two groups that stood out. Young people overwhelmingly want system change, not just small change. But the other group that voted for Bernie in large numbers were Latinos, you know, and Latinos are the backbone of our food system. And they come from a tradition that not too far away, a rural agricultural. And I think that's a good basis. We also have middle class consumers, especially women, who are really concerned about health and really concerned about their children. And then we also have a huge number of people who care about animals and the environment. So we can't do it as the food movement alone, but with the justice movement, I mean, Black Lives Matter. What Black people are forced to eat really matters. The fact that Black people are very underrepresented in the farming community, whereas they used to be 14% of all the farmers. These are issues now that I think we can bring up. We don't have to beat around the bush anymore. Industrial food is poison. That's the reason COVID-19 has taken so many of our elderly people and our people with frail health before their time. You know, people know that, you know, and we have to combine justice, climate, health, food, farming, and quite frankly, pleasure and joy. You know, it's like, I love to eat. I love to cook. I love to sit down for a good meal. We just got to make sure that everyone has that opportunity. And we're going to have to give away. We're going to have to subsidize organic instead of subsidizing industrial. And we're going to have to give away a lot of food or put people and money in people's pockets so that they continue buying organic food like they've been buying it the last 6 months. So,
yeah. I think there's an illusion that is created where you know, you have an industrial food system that is heavily subsidized by you and me in our tax dollars. And then the outcome of that is that they produce very inexpensive food that is the cheapest food in the history of the planet. I mean, we as Americans spend the smallest percentage of our income annually on food that is smaller than anybody in Europe. And at the same time, of course, our healthcare costs are exploding. Our lifespan is decreasing. Something is pretty off on this picture, right?
And the quality of life. You know, I mean, the shocking statistics lately that 12% of Americans have thought about committing suicide in the last 30 days. I mean, what is going on, people? We have got to change this situation. I mean, I got a 22-year-old son who keeps me in contact with what young people are thinking, you know, and he basically tells me, Dad, you know, most young people do know about the climate crisis. They just don't believe that we can do anything about it. And that's our job. We've got to cultivate hope, sow the seeds of hope and happiness and be positive. You know, it's like, I hate walking down the trails up here in northern Minnesota and seeing, you know, people with masks on and they're scared to death and so on. That still doesn't mean you can't say hello and smile, you know, and show these little kids that strangers aren't something to be afraid of because they might give you, you know, the plague. People are people, and let's be positive as we go forward. These are grim times, but we're not going to win unless we can convey to people that this is the best way to live. In this case, organic and regenerative food, farming, cooking, food chain, policy, the whole bit.
All right. Well, Ronnie, that's maybe a wonderful place to stop. Ronnie Cummins, I thank you so much for talking with me today. You've worked hard for many years to build a better world, and I thank you.
Well, we're going to get it. All right. Thank you,
Dave.
All right,
Ronnie. Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. I hope that you enjoyed this, and I hope that you'll subscribe and tell your friends and leave us a rating. It really does make a difference about how many people get to see these podcasts, which are an amazing library of conversations with organic leaders and thinkers from around the world. You can find a video version of this interview on realorganicproject.org/episode96. Please join us next time when our guest is Javier Zamora, a California farmer and worker rights activist. He's a special guy, and it was a real honor to talk with him last summer. To support this podcast and our certified project, become a recurring donor at realorganicproject.org.